Hi, welcome to the Fantastic Forecast, episode 417. I'm Dave Elliott, and I feel like a podcaster reborn. Today, Fantastic Four, issue 417. Okay. Fantastic Four, number one, from November 1996. Renaissance, plot and pencils by Jim Lee, script by Brandon Choi. And so we've reached the first reboot of Fantastic Four, and possibly the most controversial. I've been thinking a lot about this issue lately, and I've come to the conclusion that this might be one of the most significant comic books of the last 20 years. One of the things I've always loved about Marvel Comics, especially when compared to DC Comics, is that with Marvel, continuity has always been so important. The Fantastic Four that appeared in issue 1 in 1961 is the same Fantastic Four that appeared 35 years later in issue 416, and they're the same characters that appear in FF 645 in the year 2015. While DC periodically reboots and gives us new versions of Batman, Superman, and company, the Marvel characters have traditionally stayed the same. The Marvel Universe has been a consistent, single universe since 1939. However, here with Heroes Reborn, for the first time, Marvel says, screw it. Screw continuity. We're starting the FF over again. Which was a major sore spot with me. I love continuity, and I think a lot of Marvel fans feel the same way. Having Marvel chunk out 35 years of continuity, you know, 35 years of the FF's history, that was a big deal. You kind of expect that stuff from DC, but not Marvel. Now, people hated Heroes Reborn for the most part, and the entire thing was scrapped after a year. The Fantastic Four and the Avengers were brought back to the normal Marvel Universe with their previous continuity intact. But oddly enough, this didn't dissuade Marvel from mucking with continuity in the future. And 10 years later, they would do the same thing with Spider-Man, using Mephisto to rip apart Spider-Man's past, and in the process, chunk out 20 years of his history. I haven't read any new Spider-Man comics since then. And there are rumors, here in 2015, that the upcoming summer crossover event will see even bigger style shakeup, possibly some kind of Crisis on the Infinite Earth style reboot of the Marvel Universe, or maybe a version of DC's New 52 in Marvel. Either way, I just can't figure why Marvel would try to copy DC Comics. The one thing that makes Marvel special is their cohesive universe with a history that dates all the way back to 1939 and the Submariner and the original Human Torch. The powers that be at Marvel don't seem as slavishly obsessed and devoted to continuity as they did in the past, and I feel like Heroes Reborn was a big part of letting that genie out of the bottle when it comes to erasing their continuity. Another thing that makes this issue and Heroes Reborn so important is that even though it wasn't successful, this did give Marvel an idea, at least I think it did, of creating a separate universe where they could start the stories of the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, along with the X-Men and Spider-Man over again. This issue very much seems like the inspiration for what would later become the Ultimate Universe. Also significant is the fact that this is the first time the Fantastic Four was canceled and rebooted with the number one issue, something Marvel will continue to do over and over and over again. Not with just the Fantastic Four, but all their comics, but especially with the Fantastic Four. And finally, this issue is even more significant for DC Comics. Here in this issue, Jim Lee reboots the Fantastic Four, retells their origin, redesigns their costumes, and starts everything all over again from scratch. 15 years later, he will be hired by DC Comics to do the exact same thing to their entire line of comics. Jim Lee redesigns the costumes of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and many others, and oversees the launch of DC's New 52. And so the legacy wrought by this issue with the Fantastic Four is pretty immense. The Ultimate Universe, Spider-Man One More Day, The New 52. Imagine how different Marvel and DC would be now if Jim Lee had not decided that he wanted to write and draw the Fantastic Four. So that brings us to the issue itself, and the story starts off with that infamous ride into space with Reed Richards, Sue Storm, Johnny Storm, and Ben Grimm on that spacecraft, when things go terribly wrong, well, things go terribly wrong for Ben, for the others, it's not so bad. The ship gets bombarded with radiation. Reed orders Ben to turn the ship around and head back to Earth. Johnny starts bursting into flames, which, as you can imagine, is a little disconcerting. Ben Grimm thinks all his friends are dying. It seems like they're cutting right to the chase, but they're not. An intercom goes off. Ben gets a call. It turns out this is not the infamous ride into space. We'd have to wait a long time for that to happen in this issue. Ben is just using the flight simulator. One of the supervisors says that Ben isn't very good, and it's no surprise that he never advanced beyond being a test pilot. Reed defends his old friend, saying that had he not been wounded in the Gulf War, he might have become an astronaut. We learn that Ben is training to be the pilot on a spaceship called the Excelsior, which must be Reed's ship. Clever name. Next, we see the Excelsior, the ship, is huge. This time they're not trying to beat the Russians into space, but the ship has a quantum drive developed by Reed, which will allow them to explore space. Someone comes out on the tarmac with a telephone and says it's a call for Reed from Miss Storm herself, calling from New York, making it sound like Sue's some kind of big shot. Ben takes the call since Reed is busy, and he asks her, "How's life in the corporate boardroom?"
"Who's this has ever been?" she replies.
She asks to speak to Reed. Ben says he's busy. What does she need? We learn that Sue is his boss. She works at the Storm Foundation. She says she's flying out to Central City to check on the project. And Johnny's coming, too. He wants some memorabilia from the Excelsior to put in his casino. They run the Storm Casinos. This is also weird. She was wondering if Reed could pick her up at the airport, but he seems busy. So she says she'll take a limo. Oh, poor thing. She has to take the damn limo. There's a knock on her door, and she says she has to go. Two men come in, and it's an older man, Uncle Matthew, and a Native American gentleman. Uncle Matt introduces him to Sue as Special Agent Wyatt Wingfoot, and saying that he's in charge of the Excelsior Project now. Yes, he's in charge of the Excelsior Project, not the casinos. So Sue isn't happy with this, but the change was authorized by the President of the United States himself. NASA has detected unusual energy fluctuations within the stellar anomaly, so Wyatt says it was determined that this was a threat to national security, and Wyatt was put in charge. He says that he and his men will be traveling to California with Sue to take custody of the spaceship. Back near Central City, a reporter, Colleen Chang, is on TV saying that there are rumors that the government is working on a top-secret project nearby to make contact with alien life. And this comes as a stellar anomaly was discovered just outside our solar system. Reed and his co-worker are watching this on TV. The co-worker turns it off, calling it hogwash, even though she was pretty damn close to reporting the truth, which is what Reed says. What she doesn't know is that Reed thinks the stellar manifestation could be an emerging subspace wormhole that serves as a conduit for subatomic particles. This issue may be different from FF Volume 1, Number 1 in many ways, but it is just as wordy. Maybe wordier than Stan Lee. Brandon Choi is scripting the shit out of this issue. Words, words, words. Reed says this may end up allowing them to make contact with alien life. That's what the project is all about anyway. And Reed says he doesn't want to let down Sue Storm. Another major difference here, Sue is not a teenage girl, and Reed isn't in his 40s. They appear to be pretty close in age. And where's the fun in that? The co-worker says he believes in Reed, but he's worried about Major Grimm. Speaking of Major Grimm, he's out in the desert, driving the Jeep to the spaceship base. He mentions that they don't have paved roads, because I guess Jim Lee decided to draw the Jeep on an unpaved road. He almost gets hit by a Lamborghini, and Ben screams out, "Watch out, you idiot!" The window rolls down, and it's a sexy woman with long brown hair and green eyes. I'm guessing this is not Elijah the Scroll. "Hey there, handsome," she says, and she tells him that she's lost and asks Ben for some help. Ben is like, "It'll be my pleasure." How the hell does some woman like that get lost driving her Lamborghini around in the desert on an unpaved road? Well, we see someone else in the Lamborghini, driving. It's Johnny Storm, who laughs at Ben and says, "Dream on, old man. You'll never be able to keep up with Tiffany. She likes her men young, and her car is fast." But then again, don't we all? Ben yells back, "Johnny Storm, I should have known it was you. Always the boy playing with a man's toy." Oh, good job there, Brandon Choi. Already developing some homoerotic playfulness between Ben and Johnny. Johnny speeds off down the dirt road, turns around facing Ben, and drives back toward him. So now, they're playing a game of chicken. Ben is ready to call his bluff. They speed toward each other, and Tiffany's like, "You're both crazy! Stop the car!" Ben almost rams into Johnny, but Johnny swerves at the last second. How typical. Tiffany is pissed, saying that she wants out. She's going to walk back to town. And Johnny don't care. "Fine, whatever," he says. Soon, Ben is at the Central City Airport to pick up Sue. I thought he was going to the spaceship base. I guess he was going to the Central City Airport, which doesn't have paved roads. I guess it would be hard to get a limo to pick you up in the middle of a desert. So she introduces Ben to Special Agent Wyatt Wingfoot, who says that he's heard a lot about Ben. And later, back with Reed and Johnny, they find out that the government has taken over the Excelsior Project. Reed is about to hit the roof. The Storm Foundation is in charge of this stuff. He asks, "By whose authority?" And Wyatt Wingfoot enters the room with Ben and Sue. Wyatt says that he's a special agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. and he was authorized to take over by the President of the United States. He tells Reed that there's a danger posed by the stellar anomaly, but Reed disagrees, saying that the stellar anomaly isn't dangerous. "I don't care. Your opinion now is irrelevant, Dr. Richards." Wow. Great work on Wyatt Wingfoot here. They've turned him into a dick. They've also turned Johnny into a spoiled rich little asshole. Not sure that's an improvement. Now, Ben wants to clobber Wyatt, and for the second issue in a row, Reed holds back Ben and tells him that violence won't solve anything. Reed must not know this is a comic book, where, unlike real life, violence solves everything. Wyatt, becoming an even bigger dick, says that Ben and Reed are a risk to his operations and orders them both locked up. Wyatt orders Johnny and Sue to register their hand imprints into the biometric scanner in order to input the final launch codes into the command console. So they both do that, and then Sue says that's it. That's all that she's gonna do. Wyatt orders them both to be confined to quarters. Johnny says he's gonna call his lawyer, and Wyatt orders one of his goons to punch Johnny in the face. The spaceship is gonna be launched in an hour. One of the other scientists says that he's gonna call the police, so Wyatt zaps the dude in the back with some kind of electronic brass knuckles, killing the guy. Wyatt orders Sue and Johnny taken away, and then he contacts his boss on the communicator, telling him that everything is going as planned. His boss is, take a guess, it's Dr. Doom. Wyatt and his men don't really work for S.H.I.E.L.D. They work for Dr. Doom. Now that Reed, Sue, Ben, and Johnny are their prisoners, I guess Doom will be sending them back in time to look for Blackbeard's treasure. One can only hope. I think at this point, Doom is more interested in stealing that spaceship. A little later, Reed and Ben are locked up in a cell together. Ben has a nice view out the window of the Excelsior spaceship. He notices they're loading a nuclear bomb onto the ship. Reed figures they want to blow up the stellar anomaly for some reason. I hope they do it soon. I'm getting tired of having to say the phrase stellar anomaly over and over again. Reed says they're helpless to stop them, but Ben says, don't count on it. Back with Johnny and Sue, they're being led off by a couple of Wyatt's goons. They pass Johnny's car. He secretly hits a button on his remote control, and the car starts honking. With the two goons distracted, Sue and Johnny fight back. Johnny hits one guy in the face with what appears to be a lead pipe. I'm not sure where he got that from. And then Sue leaps up in the air and kicks the other guy in the face. And I'm really not sure where that came from. She's not only a corporate executive, she's a master kickboxer. They run back into the base. They fight off a bad guy who's guarding Ben and Reed. They set them free. Once free, Reed gives Sue a big kiss. Isn't that kind of improper for her to be carrying on with an employee? Reed says they have to stop Wingfoot and his plans for the Excelsior. And on the next panel, the four of them are getting into their astronaut suits. Ben points out how dangerous this is, but Johnny says they've already put their lives on the line and they should stay together. And for the second issue in a row, the four of them get together, they stack their hands one on top of another, and they pledge to stay together. They hear the rumble of the Excelsior's engines, they look over, and they see it taking off. They want to get into space, too, to stop the Excelsior. I'm not sure why Reed is so dead set on saving that stellar anomaly from getting nuked, but he is. Oh no! Dr. Doom is going to destroy the stellar anomaly! We must risk our lives to save the stellar anomaly! So they decided to take the Excelsior prototype, which doesn't have as much fuel as the Excelsior, or the same amount of shielding. How convenient. They get aboard the prototype, get it ready for takeoff, they blast off. Wyatt Wingfoot and his men, they see the launch, but they can't stop it. So the FF get... Reed, Sue, Ben, Johnny, they get into space to the stellar anomaly where the Excelsior is already there, about to do what it's going to do. Ben says the sensors are picking up increased subspace activity, and Reed says it's some kind of signal, like someone trying to contact them. And then there's a bunch of radiation, too much for the prototype's shields to stop. They see something coming out of the subspace distortion field, and the Excelsior drops its nukes. The nuclear bombs explode, and the prototype ship gets bombarded with radiation. The ship starts to break apart. Ben turns the ship back into Earth's atmosphere. Everyone heads for the escape pods. Wait a minute. I thought the stellar anomaly was on the edge of the solar system. Right here, it's like right in orbit over Earth. So Ben turns the ship back into Earth's atmosphere. Everyone heads for the escape pods, and the ship crash lands in the Caribbean Sea. And the escape pods parachute right down after it. Near the Bermuda Triangle, of course. First, we see Johnny emerge from the wreckage. And unlike the creators of this book, he's on fire. He says that he feels like some kind of human torch, and he flies over and he lands in the water to put out his flames. He gets out of the water, and he sees this long, flesh-colored tube on the ground. So Johnny picks it up and he says, "It feels like flesh, warm to the touch." Which is a weird thing for him to say, because Johnny is wearing gloves. How the hell can he tell it feels like flesh if he's wearing gloves? He wonders what the fleshy tube is connected to. Usually when I say something like that, I'm talking about Ben. And Johnny goes on over to find, at one end, a hand. Pretty gross. And then on the other end, he finds the rest of Reed laying on the beach. Reed is worried about the cosmic radiation. He says he's not sure how long they have to live. Johnny flicks his fingers and shows off his new flaming powers. Reed demonstrates his ability to stretch out his body parts at will. He says the radiation has mutated their biomolecular structures, giving them fantastic powers. Reed grabs the memory chip from the black box and they head off to find Sue and Ben. Back with Ben, he's having a tough time, he's in a lot of pain, as he's slowly turning into an orange rock monster. And over with Sue, she notices the quantum drive from the crashed ship. The core containment shield has been damaged, and if it explodes, she says it could destroy the entire island completely. So she runs off to find the others. The first person she comes across is a pile of orange rocks. And then first, Ben says, "Please, help me." And Sue's like, "Is that you, Ben?" And then he tells her to get away from him, and he stands up to reveal that he's been turned into a huge rock monster. She tells Ben, "Wait, there's something behind you! Look out!" And Ben says, "What the?" Johnny and Reed hear Sue scream off in the distance and they run that way. The ground starts to collapse under their feet and they slide down this tunnel into the ground. They hit the bottom, they look up to see they're surrounded by these little yellow men, the subterranean moloid people. They pick up Reed and Johnny and carry them through the caves. They get to this big cavern where they see Sue and a big orange rock monster locked up in chains. And it looks like Sue is about to be eaten by some grotesque creature, like she's being sacrificed. But suddenly, she turns invisible. Ben looks back at her and wonders if she's already been eaten. So he gets pissed off, He breaks out of his chains and he starts to clobber the creature. Sue turns visible again, and she's not sure how she did that. Reed and Johnny come stretching and flying to join Sue and Ben. They realize that the orange rock monster is Ben. The big creature is back, still hungry to eat Sue. That was a common thing back in the early days of the FF. Bad guys wanting to eat Sue. And Sue mentions the quantum drive, which was about to explode. And then the leader of the subterranean people show up. He says that the only thing they're going to do now is perish. That's what happens to trespassers. He introduces himself as the Mole Man, and he says that he has the power to bring all of mankind to its knees. I do like Jim Lee's Mole Man. He looks a lot more sinister and dangerous than old school Mole Man. Still, I doubt he has the power to bring mankind to its knees. So whether or not that's true, we'll have to find out next issue, because this issue is done. So that's the end of the first issue of FF, Heroes Reborn. Pretty much taking the first half of FF number 1, volume 1, and stretching it out over 40 pages. Jim Lee's art is pretty. Other than that, it's a pretty pointless exercise in retelling the origin of the FF, only making it more complicated than it needs to be. Making Sue and Johnny the spoiled children of a super-rich father doesn't really strike me as an improvement. And turning Wyatt Wingfoot into a minion of Dr. Doom, that's a real head-scratcher. We don't see Jim Lee's redesigned FF uniforms in this story. They are on the cover, and we'll get a better look at them in future issues. The new uniforms will have that kind of collar you see on a Nehru jacket. Jim Lee loves those things. He even gave one to Superman, which looks so stupid. And of course, they will have lots of unnecessary straps on their arms and legs. Clearly, Jim Lee has some kind of S&M fetish. Always putting these odd straps on people. I never understood that about Jim Lee. How was someone who is so terrible at something, namely, designing superhero uniforms, gets asked to do that something over and over and over again? It would be like me getting asked to do other podcasts, which doesn't happen. Of course, in all fairness to Jim Lee, the FF uniforms will get redesigned many more times in the next 19 years, and none of them will look any good. The only costume redesign I ever liked was when John Byrne switched them from black and blue to white and blue. Not a big change, but they look damn good. So, if you have any questions about the Fantastic Four, about this podcast, or if you need relationship advice, you can email me at podcastff@gmail.com. You can download other episodes at iTunes or find them all at www.podcastff.podbean.com. My other podcast, Comic Book Doggerel, D-O-G-G-E-R-E-L, can be found at iTunes or search for it at podomatic.com. There's only like 5 episodes. Email me if you want more. So long, kids. This podcast is over.